In 2019, the Film and Whiskey podcast nearly collapsed under the weight of a Hollywood classic.
In 2021, we try a bourbon from a resurrected brand.
This is E.T. the Extraterrestrial,
The Revisit.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm usually more right than Bob Book.
No, that's debatable. but what's your name, sir?
Oh, I'm Brad.
Oh, hey,
hi,
Brad.
Everybody.
This week we are doing something special. I guess we could lead in with our bonus episode intro. Welcome into the podcast.
Yeah. Bonus episode.
We're revisiting a movie from season one. We're going to do this every season. Last year, we revisited Goodfellas in hopes that Brad would come to his senses. He did not. And this season, we left it open to our listeners about which movie we would revisit. So once again, they picked a movie from season one, E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Brad, this episode came out towards the end of season one, September of 2019. So it has been almost two full years since we've watched this movie together. First of all, honestly, I can't believe it's been that long. And then I think to how much stuff has happened in both of our lives since we last watched this movie. And I'm like, okay, I guess it is. It has been a long time.
Yeah, this entire thing called a pandemic happened.
You know.
There were fires in Australia. There were all sorts of great... there was an election.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean,
there's a lot that's happened.
I was thinking more of the fact that you and I have both brought humans into the world since then.
Yeah, procreation, man.
Whoa. This is already off the rails. So, Brad, we are revisiting E.T. today. At the end of that episode, I gave it a 10 out of 10. I still think this is a fantastic movie. You were way cooler on it. You gave it a 6 out of 10. And it was the first time you'd ever seen E.T., which, if we could just kind of start there, I think, you know, re-listening to that episode again this week in preparation for this, that's one of the things that stood out to me the most. I am really surprised that at no point growing up did you see this movie. It just kind of seems like one that would have been in the rotation at the G household.
I mean, as somebody who now has a daughter of his own, I can understand why my parents wouldn't want me watching, you know, movies that encourage getting drunk as a 9-year-old.
That, I don't know if encourage is the right word.
I mean, he's like making out with girls and like leering it at small children. It's a movie that I can understand why, you know, it shouldn't be seen by general audiences.
That's really funny. Yeah, this does seem like, you know, depending on where you're coming out on this movie, and I don't want to jump into that too quickly. This does seem like it could be just another check mark in your list of reasons I don't like the 1980s. Which is well documented on this show.
Yes, I despise the 1980s. I think the music is mostly overrated. The movies are mostly garbage. But honestly, Bob, growing up in the 90s, this just wasn't a movie that I watched. We never had cable, so it's not like I was able to just catch it on cable somewhere. Honestly, I feel like I need to like get my parents on the podcast to talk about whether or not they had seen E.T. in the 80s. I don't even know if they saw it to love it to, you know, have us watch it.
You know,
I just never watched it until 2019.
I have a feeling they saw it. We should get, you know, Mom and Dad G on this show to talk about it. Maybe they can call into the Anchor website and we'll play it on the air or something. Okay, Brad, we're diving back into this movie. And I think one of the things that really stood out to me this time, you know, and I was kind of texting you some things and I sent you like a GIF that I made of one of the shots in the movie. We already knew, you know, Spielberg is known for his ability to move the camera. The camera is almost always moving. There's a really great video on YouTube I would encourage everyone to go watch. It's about the Spielberg Oneer. And basically what that means is that Spielberg is known for having these really long shots where it doesn't cut away. And it basically ends up being like three shots in one because it moves from one side of the room to the other. And things that you would usually need like three setups to accomplish, Spielberg can do in one. And I'm really excited to talk to you about some of the more like nitty gritty filmmaking stuff, because I think now we've watched enough movies. You know, we've watched nearly 100 movies since the E.T. episode. that I think some of those things probably stood out to you a little bit more this time. So let's just jump right into talking about Spielberg's direction, the cinematography, the editing. Like, what really stood out to you this time around that maybe didn't the first time?
I think one specific shot that I really liked that I think characterizes Spielberg in general is when the kids are playing D&D and Elliot comes back in after having seen E.T. in the shed, kind of. And he's like, guys, there's something out in the shed. Like, you got to come see it. Like, the camera just kind of sits in one spot in the kitchen. And then it follows the teenagers as they, like, grab knives. And they're like, don't worry, Mom, we're going to protect you. And then the way that the camera just slowly shifts to the right and zooms in on them as they go around the table, out the door. And then you see them, like, through the windows as they run out towards the shed. It's probably like a 20 to 25 second camera shot that just moves barely enough to keep you with the action. And I really liked that shot. It was really beautiful.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect example, because this movie is a combination of, you know, Spielberg knowing when he can use a shot that definitely calls attention to itself and when to use shots that are so seamless that they don't call any attention to themselves. And I think that shot that you just mentioned definitely falls into that, like, second category. There's a couple that I messaged to you. One where Elliot is first walking outside to investigate the noises out there, and the camera's pointed at the ground, and you can see his shadow approaching through the screen door, and then it tilts up, and then it pushes in on Elliot as he gets closer to the camera, and he's silhouetted in profile. Like, it is just the most cinematic-looking thing, and it definitely calls attention to itself. But then there's other shots where, like at the end of the movie, where Elliot and Mike are in the van with E.T. and they're driving away with those guys, like in the tubing, hanging out the back. There's a crane shot as they're kind of like going over a hill, and the camera's kind of pulling back and like craning up at the same time. And it's just one of those little shots. It lasts maybe 3 seconds and then they cut to the next thing. But, you know, it's not calling attention to itself. And even in the moment, I was like, oh, that setup, like to get that shot set up probably took hours and hours. And just Spielberg knows exactly how to keep things moving without having to do like the Michael Bay one cut every, you know, 0.3 seconds. And it really just, I mean, again, watching this movie, I think really solidified for me, Spielberg is just such a master filmmaker. He knows exactly what he wants to do. He knows how to keep the narrative going just visually. And this was definitely an example of that.
Yeah, I mean, it's consistently one of the more smooth movies I've ever seen. You know, like you said, there's nothing jarring about this film. And I think that he does that intentionally to fit with the story. Like, he wants you to understand the transition of Elliot from childhood to growing into a sense of confidence in himself. And he doesn't want you to feel like that's like a jarring, shaking, scared type of journey. And you kind of get that the way the film is cut together. So I think you really do see Spielberg on top of his game when it comes to the camera movement, the way he sets up shots. It's a very well-pictured movie.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I'm glad that we are at least finding common ground so far on Spielberg. In the first episode we did on this, we talked about the performances a lot, and we spent a lot of time talking about these child actors. Obviously, Henry Thomas is just incredible, just an incredible performance. But you and I both really, really liked the performance by Robert McNaughton as Mike. And once again, I think that he pulls a lot of the weight of the movie here as kind of the older brother who's skeptical, but, you know, wants to help out, who wants to be, you know, kind of quote unquote the man of the house, but is also still a kid. Once again, I just feel like we have to call him out for as good of a performance as he gives in this movie.
Yeah, I think for me, he really is like, he's almost like the bridge between the adult characters and the truly like child characters.
Mm-hmm.
And so for him, I feel like you almost get to see Elliot's future a little bit. And that you can see that with somebody caring for him in his life, Elliot's going to be all right. And I think that McNaughton just does such a masterful job of being like the perfect older brother. Mm-hmm. Like, he's kind of a mean, he's kind of a dick sometimes, but never in a way that like actually sabotages their relationship. And every single time it matters, he comes through for Elliot. And I think that's what makes his performance so compelling.
I think this time around, I was really attracted to the number of like kind of quippy one-liners that this movie has. And I love the script in general. I think it's an incredibly well-structured movie. And we're going to get into talking again about the idea of this movie as basically just like one giant metaphor for divorce, for the father-son relationship, which I think is pretty obvious when you know to look for it. But I really loved some of these, you know, like when they first have E.T. in Elliot's room and he's first introduced them to Mike and to Gertie, and they're bringing him food and they're trying to figure out what he is. And Mike's like, is it a monkey with no hair? And Drew Barrymore's just, is he a pig? He sure eats like one. It's just like little things like that really, really make me laugh throughout the movie. I think, honestly, Brad, half of my notes on this movie are just one-liners that they say to each other throughout the movie. You know, like Elliot and Mike are walking down the driveway, and he's asking him, like, how did you explain to E.T. that you have to go to school? And he just says, how do you explain school to higher intelligence? Like, it was just, there's little quippy things like that that I think really kind of lighten up the movie and kind of keep it moving along and keeping it fresh throughout.
I think my favorite line for the movie is just, shut up, Greg.
You know, that's really funny. I wrote that down, too. I love that throughout the movie, they just consistently shit on Greg.
Just always.
Like at the end, when they first meet the resurrected E.T., and he's like, can't he just beam up? And he goes, this is reality, Greg. I just love that there's the one guy in the group that everyone's like, yeah, F that guy.
Yeah, and I think that that's like another thing that points towards Spielberg as this like manipulator of nostalgia. That like every little itty bitty part of this movie is designed to make you feel like you're a part of this small town community where like, yeah, every group of friends has a Greg in it that you just kind of always crap on. And, you know, every sibling relationship, you know, they fight and they get into stuff sometimes. But overall, they love each other and care for each other. And Spielberg just always does a good job of portraying something that the audience like wants to be a part of.
Yeah. Well, and I think even, you know, the screenwriter, Melissa Matheson, she kind of figures out pretty early on, too, how do we make each plot development a really entertaining development, not just necessary for the plot? So, you know, E.T. learns how to talk and it becomes really necessary for him to say things like phone home. But after that, they're like, all right, how do we have some fun with this? And so you immediately have that trick-or-treating thing where he's dressed up as Gertie and the mom doesn't know. And you have like, thank you, thank you, thank you. Little things like that, I think, really lighten up the movie. When he reaches out from under that sheet because he sees that Mike has that fake knife strapped to his head and he's just going, ouch, ouch, ouch. And they're trying to put his hand back under the sheet. They do a really good job of kind of like scattering those gags throughout the movie, but also not making them detract or distract from the main plot.
I think the hard part for me with that is that I agree it lightens up the movie, but until E.T. dies, there's literally nothing heavy in the movie at all to give it any like weight or ballast to move things forward.
I don't know. I feel like you get glimpses of it, though. Like you have the mom talking to the policeman when Elliot disappears and like talking for the first time out loud about that her and her husband have separated and she starts crying. You have the scene where Elliot and Mike are in the garage and they find their dad's shirt and they're reminiscing about the smell of his cologne. And so I think that the heavier moments are there, or they're at least hinted at. But again, one of the things that I have always appreciated about this movie is that it's told from the perspective of the kids. Like, you don't have the kids having these long soliloquies about how divorce is affecting them. You just get these little glimpses where they say things like, remember how dad used to take us to the movies? And I think that says more than if you had had Elliot go on this really long monologue about, you know, his emotional turmoil or whatever.
Yeah, Bob, and honestly, that kind of like takes us into talking about the script a little bit, which is probably the area I struggle with the most with this movie. I'm never really gripped by this story. I get it. Elliot's like struggling with the fact that his dad's gone and, you know, their family's trying to stick together and stuff. And, you know, oh, he hates being in Mexico, but he's down there with his whore. Like I get it. That's all happening. But when it comes down to it, like this movie, you know, you talked about it being specifically about divorce. I feel like this is a Magic Dog movie.
Hmm.
Like, Elliot gets this magic dog that is perfect and makes everything better and nothing bad can happen. And that's it. It's just this magic dog that can do cool stuff and get him drunk and get him inspired by television that E.T. is watching to kiss this girl. And it all just feels so utterly convenient. And I the script of this movie feels like Lassie, but with a magical dog.
Interesting.
Instead.
Yeah. I mean, like, first of all, I disagree with that, but I see where you're coming from. And I was thinking about this morning as I prepared for the takedown that's going to happen in the second part of this episode. You know, I think most of the time that I come across as probably like the more cynical one of the two of us on this podcast. And yet I thought back to all the movies that we've watched for this podcast that are like sentimental in nature, right? And I think we could probably say like this is a sentimental kind of movie. That's what Spielberg is known for, kind of schmaltzy stuff.
Yeah, for sure.
The ones that you watched as a kid, you seem to have a soft spot for still. And the ones that you didn't watch till you were an adult, or at least like later childhood, I think that you're pretty harsh on kind of sappy, sentimental movies as an adult. And I didn't really put two and two together until this morning. So before we go to our whiskey break, I'll let your point stand, Brad, but I want to hear your response to, like, have you become a jaded, cynical jerk in your old age?
No, not really. there's a lot of cheesy movies that I like. I think that the two things that make me struggle with this movie is what I'm now terming magic dog syndrome. And then the second thing, which I'm going to term as burnt gnome syndrome. The animatronics just don't work for me, dude. And the costume that they made for E.T., he literally looks like a burn victim.
Yikes.
Like, I was watching it this time, and I'm like, he looks like this weird gnome with a long neck and a burn victim. Hmm. And by the end of the movie, he literally is a burn victim. His skin is just all white and falling away. And so it's a mixture of those two things where I agree with you. I think that if I had watched this when I was like 4, 5, 6 years old, sure, maybe I would be nostalgic towards it and go, yeah, this is great. But in my mind, I'm not like bound by that nostalgia to give it a higher score. And honestly, like, I know that a lot of people really love this movie, but in the end, like, it's got a 78% on audience score on Rotten Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. It has a 7.8 on IMDb. This isn't like a beloved audience, like, nobody can ever pass up. Just in the last few days, I've talked to a few of my friends about it, and all of my friends are like, yeah, I'm just not the biggest fan. Like, I'm sure it was good in 82, but it doesn't really hold up well.
Yeah, so I can't disagree with any of that. Like, that is a fact. People, I would say newer generations don't seem to be latching onto this movie the same way. I don't necessarily know what to make of that, but I think we should hit pause before we kind of try to dissect that. Brad, let's jump into our whiskey for the day, which is this old William Tarr Manchester Reserve. What do you say?
Let's get to it.
All right, so today we are checking out Old William Tarr Manchester Reserve, which is a 7-year age-stated whiskey. It's actually, Brad, a blend of 8-year-old rye and 7-year-old bourbon. Now, I don't know the exact proportions that they blend this thing to, but the rye that they use in this is 37% corn, 51% rye, and 12% barley. So kind of a high corn rye, if that makes sense. And then the bourbon is 75% corn, 13 rye, 12% barley. This brand was well known in Lexington, Kentucky, you know, like 100 years ago, very similar to the story of Kentucky Peerless in Louisville. This is happening a lot in the world of whiskey right now. They're finding these old brands that have fallen into, you know, disrepair and closed down. And so the name is no longer copyrighted. and smart people are recopywriting those names so that they can say that their brand has history, and then they're relaunching these as kind of startups. So right now, they're using sourced whiskey. Obviously, they just launched this, you know, a year and a half ago, and they're using 8- and 7-year-old whiskey here. I don't have a problem with any of that. I just think that it's, you know, we should upfront be transparent about like what the business is. But to us, honestly, all that matters is, what does this stuff taste like? And Brad, you already said right before we hit record here, this is smelling pretty good.
Yeah, it's got like a really nice, just like thick sweetness to it. It's almost like a thick butterscotch pudding. There's a little bit of a nuttiness to it that feels like a peanut butter pie. And then on top of that, there's like a hint of fruitiness, like an apple that kind of comes through. It just smells like sugar and sweetness and delicious. So, but it also has a heaviness to it that belays its 114 proof nature.
Yeah, I did forget to mention that this is 114 proof. I'm really enjoying this, Brad. I do think it has like a little bit of an aged character to it. It smells kind of dusty a little bit, and I really, really like that. To go with those sort of cherry, I'm getting a lot of cherry on the nose. It has those nice fruit characteristics. I wouldn't quite say this smells like cherry pie. It doesn't quite have enough of that like bready character, but you do get a ton of brown sugar, a lot of vanilla, and then cherry on the nose as well. I'm interested to see where this goes, Brad. Let's take a sip. Oh. Oh.
Holy cow.
Oh, this is like, I thought I had this pegged down like 3 different times and then it shape-shifted. I don't know. Did you have that experience? Like, it was really nice and sweet. And then I went to swallow and it got really, really oaky.
Yep.
And then right before it turned oaky, it had a lot of that kind of, what was that one from Willett that we drank? The Noah's Mill, the one that I always call funky. Like, it definitely had some of that on there too. But then at the back, it went really, really oaky. And I don't know. I don't know if I would call this complex or disjointed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that kind of on the front end, you have like a classic bourbon experience. And then on the back end, you have a classic rye experience.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're finishing with a lot of like spices, rye, like a little bit of oakiness. But at the front end, I mean, it's caramel, it's vanilla, it's butterscotch. And I feel like in the middle there, you almost get some like nice refreshing notes of like mint almost. It's a fascinating whiskey that, you know, if we were scoring this out, I have a feeling it would be above 35, if not close to 40 for me.
You know what? Honestly, man, the second and third sip of this really take this up a notch. I think the first sip, my palate just wasn't ready. It wasn't acclimated. And the second sip, it's all cherry for me. And then on the back, it's rye. You're right. It's like, you know, I don't want to compare this to like a flavored rye, but it just has such strong kind of berry characteristics to it. And then lots of oak, lots of rye. I think your mint note was really well put as well. And there's a little bit of citrus on this for me. Man, I'm really enjoying this. It's also super thick. Like, it's really viscous.
Yeah, the viscosity is like off the charts here. Bob, I am going to put the rest of my sample in my Infinity bottle.
Well, before you do that, you know what? I think we should score this out, Brad. Like, they sent us these samples. They were nice enough to send us a second sample because I think the first one got lost in the mail. I think we should at least do them the honor of giving it a full score here. So let's just go like as quick as we can. I'm going to say that I would give this a 7.5 on the nose. I'm going to give it a 9 on the taste. The finish is powerful. Like, there's quite a bit of a Kentucky hug, but it's not harsh. It's just like, hey, I'm here. I'm 114 proof. I'd give it an 8 on the finish. Overall balance, I think I'd give it like an 8.5. And then we'll talk about value in a minute. But where do you think you'd come out on your first four categories, Brad?
Honestly, Bob, I think this is a phenomenal whiskey. I'm going to go 8.999.
Wow. All right.
Like, I am really impressed. The nose like hits you in all the right spots and lets you know it's coming. And then the taste, the finish, the balance is just off the charts delicious.
All right. So the downside to this is, in terms of value, this carries a suggested retail price of $80. Now, I actually don't think that's terrible when you consider that we're using 8-year-old rye, 7-year-old bourbon. They're blending them together before bottling and then releasing it as a sort of smaller, you know, non-distilling producer. I don't think this is astronomically priced, and especially at barrel proof, like, you know, they're taking some loss on just what's been evaporated, especially from the rye. So is $80 cheap? No. Is $80 the perfect price for this? No. But I think I'll still give it a 7 out of 10 on value.
I think I'll give it an 8 out of 10 on value. Like, if I'm going to spend $80 on a whiskey, it better be as good as this.
Mm-hmm.
Like I would put this up there. The only way I would balk at this is if it hit triple digits. Like, if this was like 99 and up, I would be like, oh, that's pretty high for this, even though it's really good. But $80, man, I feel like you're getting a good value for a really good whiskey.
Yeah,
here.
I agree. I'm coming out to a 40 out of 50. And I think, Brad, you're going to be a little higher than me here.
43 out of 50.
43. So we're coming out to an average of a 41.5 out of 50 or an 83 out of 100. This is a no-brainer recommendation for me.
Yeah, go pick it up. If you can get it at the bar, if you can get a bottle, this is a phenomenal whiskey that you need to try.
All right, Brad, let's get back into talking about E.T. What do you say?
Yeah, let's get to it.
All right, that was Old William Tarr Manchester Reserve 7-year blended whiskey, a whiskey that we are incredibly high on. And we're getting back into talking about E.T. the Extraterrestrial, a movie I am super high on. It's kind of starting to sound like Brad may or may not have changed his opinion on this. Brad, I think we should just go ahead and dive into your overall impressions this time around. But where are you kind of coming out on this movie when it comes to, you know, did your opinion change at all?
I think that E.T. has a lot of stuff going for it. I think that the relationship between the child actors is what really draws a sense of, like, greatness to this movie. Like, the fact that the three kids just interact so smoothly and well with each other, and they have such an authentic connection, is what I think really has attracted audiences over the years. I think that Spielberg's, the way he directs the camera specifically, he's just on point in this movie. He really does a great job. The place that I'm still sticking at is that I'm not interested. I think that's like watching it again a second time. I sat down and I was like, man, we're going to watch E.T. again. I know a lot of people love it. We'll give it another try. And I'm just not super interested in the character's story and where they're going. I think that the animatronics still are a struggle for me. I think that E.T. just wasn't costumed well. I think they just did a bad job designing E.T. as an alien. So that, and you know, when the main character of the movie, or at the very least the main MacGuffin of the movie, is this alien that you're supposed to be interested in, I think you need to do a better job costuming him and designing him. So I like, honestly, Bob, I'm kind of in a similar place to where I was before. I don't know. That's kind of a summary of where I'm at.
All right. Well, before we get out of here, then, I do want to talk a little bit more about John Williams' score than we did the first time around, because, you know, one of the things that we are limited to with this podcast is we can't play music, because the way that music licenses work, it's different than, you know, if we play dialogue from a movie on here. So we can't play the Williams score. But in that first episode, I said, I think that there are kind of universes that John Williams has worked in where he has been able to build and expand and develop more themes. Like, think the Star Wars universe or the Harry Potter universe. But if we're just talking like one self-contained movie, I think this might be my favorite and maybe the best John Williams score of all. Like, this is just, it's an insane level of virtuosity that's going on here. And I was taking notes on little things that I didn't even notice in most of my watches through. But when they keep cutting outside, when the government people are kind of marching towards the house, and he has those really heavy drums that are like, dun-dun, dun-dun. That kind of stuff wasn't really happening in movies in the 80s. And I think we're so used to hearing them now because movies like this became so influential. And then they cut to nighttime when they have the house all tented up. And I never, ever noticed it before this time because I was wearing headphones. He brings out like an old silent movie kind of organ to play like the sinister government theme on. And it works so perfectly because the house looks like this kind of house of horrors. And just the decision to use these like many, many, many instruments that he uses throughout the movie. So much of the score is done on harp, which is an instrument that's so rarely used in cinema. Like, I think Williams doesn't get enough credit for this score, even though it is one of the most beloved scores ever.
Bob, you don't got to do much to get me going other than talk about John Williams as one of the greatest composers of all time. Like, his ability to craft themes that so perfectly fit the emotion of a movie is unparalleled. Mm-hmm. I literally have such a hard time thinking of other composers that can do it on such a regular basis. Like, I think that Howard Shore with Lord of the Rings, like, hit the mark that John Williams set, but I can't think of any other Howard Shore scores that really do it the same way he does it with Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Like Williams just does it over and over and over and over in everything he does, from E.T. to the stinking Olympic theme song.
Yeah.
Like he just does it. He gets it. And the music in this movie is beautiful. And I hate the fact that we can't play music. I just think it's ridiculous. Like, what if you played the main theme of the movie? Like when he says, we're flying.
Why don't we just hum it? Because they can't copyright strike us if we're badly humming it.
Well, if you want to hum while I give my final score, Bob, you are more than welcome to. But I'm honestly curious, as we get into final scores and stuff, what changed for you in this viewing? Was there anything that you came down a little lower on? Was there anything you were a little higher on? Like, you know, this is probably, what, your 19th watch of this movie?
Yeah, probably. So last time we went into it, I wasn't looking for the movie to be, like, a metaphor. And I came out of it like, oh, shit, this is the most obvious metaphor for this ever. And so I went into it this time like, I'm going to look at this movie as specifically an allegory for divorce and an allegory for strained father-son relationships. And the whole movie works that way. And I was writing down lines of dialogue, like I said earlier, that just fed into this metaphor or this allegory. Like, even when, you know, E.T. and Elliot are sick and dying and they finally pull Elliot away and he's just screaming, "You're killing him, you're killing him." In our first episode on E.T., we talked about how at various points of the movie, E.T. is a stand-in for the dad. And at other points of the movie, E.T. is a stand-in for Elliot, and how they talk about how, you know, E.T. feels his feelings, he feels E.T.'s feelings. E.T. kind of gives voice to things in Elliot that he hasn't been able to give voice to. And so when he's looking at this dying creature that all these adults are interfering with, and he's saying, like, you're killing him, in a sense, what he's talking to or what he's speaking into is his own situation. Like, all these adults are coming into the picture and trying to smooth things over with what's happening in his life, this divorce, this separation, whatever you want to call it. And it's literally like draining the life out of Elliot. When we first meet him, he's a kid with like no voice. He's a kid that no one listens to. And by the end of the movie, you've got this John Williams fanfare and timpani playing him out because he has completed that sort of arc of coming of age. And I really, really appreciated how almost every line of dialogue in the second half of the movie can be interpreted in both ways, like on its face value and also as kind of feeding this central metaphor. There's a really great moment where Drew Barrymore is crying with her mom after they've watched E.T. die, and she asks if he's dead. And then she asks, like, can we wish for him to come back? And it's a callback to an earlier scene where they're reading Peter Pan. But it's also very obviously a callback to her being able to express that she wants her dad back. And then the mom even says, like, I wish that he could come back too. And so I don't know, man. I look at this script and I know that you're not a fan of it. But I mean, it's included as one of the 100 best scripts ever written by the Writers Guild of America. And I think that once you view this movie through the lens of trauma and grief and loss and coping, like, it's really hard to dismiss this movie. And I was really hoping, because you have become such a huge fan of this YouTube channel called Cinema Therapy, that going into this movie, watching it through that lens, you might have a better experience with it. And so as you give your final score, Brad, obviously I'm staying at a 10 out of 10. I think this is basically a flawless movie. I think this might be one of the 25 best movies ever made. I want to hear not just your final score, but like watching it through that lens, did it give you more of an appreciation for the movie than you had before?
You know, coming through this movie again, I honestly don't think that that was at the forefront of my mind. Like, I guess anytime I watch a movie, I try not to watch it with specific lenses. I try to just come to it as fresh as I can and observe what I can observe. And so for me, like, was that in my mind? Sure. Like I noticed little bits and pieces of it, but it wasn't something that like overwhelmed me the way it seems to have overwhelmed you. For me, you know, you're giving it a 10 out of 10. I still just think, that's just so wildly high. If you gave it an 8.5 to even a 9.5, I'd be like, yeah, sure, I get it. You love the movie. 10 and top 25 movie of all time just feels like hyperbole to me. I am going to bring my score up though, Bob.
Hey!
I hope that you are excited that this film will get an entire 0.5 point higher of a score.
Wow.
than I gave it before. So I'll come out to a 6.5 out of 10.
Well, as we can see, you know, fatherhood and, you know, coming through a pandemic has not changed Brad at all. He is still just as cynical as he was before and just as wrong.
I prefer the term crotchety.
All right. So we want to know what you think. Have you watched E.T.? Are you one of these people that Brad has talked about that is in maybe a younger generation and has not appreciated it before? I honestly think it's worth revisiting and trying to watch through this lens of coping and recovery and trauma. I think it really, really plays well when you view it through that lens. But we want to know what you think. So please reach out to us. Let us know. Who do you side with on this? Are you Team Bob? Are you Team Brad? You can find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram at Film Whiskey.
Or you can give us a phone call. You can leave us a voicemail on our website, which is anchor.fm/filmwhiskey.
We'll be back on Monday with another regularly scheduled episode. But until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.